Cassette 4, Side 2.
You'll recall, Captain, the one brief message we got from Earth ordered us to go into hiding and keep our data secret, if possible. They also said we should use our own best judgment. Will our silence really delay the rediscovery of that Sargasso of lost ships for long, now that it's known to exist? No doubt half the patron lines in the five galaxies have swarms of scouts out now, trying to duplicate our discovery. They already know to look in a poorly linked, dim globular cluster. It's only a matter of time until they stumble across the right gravitational tide pool in the right cluster. Crydike thought that debatable. Galactics didn't often think like the Earthborn, and wouldn't conduct a search in the same way. Witness how long the fleet had lain undiscovered. Still, Metz was probably right in the long run. In that case, Doctor, why don't we simply broadcast the location to the library? It'll be public knowledge, and no longer our affair. Surely this important discovery should be investigated by a licensed team from the Institutes? Crydike was sarcastic, but he realized as Met smiled patronizingly that the human took him seriously.
You are being naive, Captain. The fanatics overhead care little about loose galactic codes when they believe the millennium is at hand. If everyone knows where the derelict fleet is, the battleground will simply move out there. Those ancient ships will be destroyed in a crossfire, no matter how powerful that weird protective field that surrounds them. And the Galactics will still strive to capture us, in case we lied.
They had arrived at the bridge lock. Crydike paused there. So, it would be better if only one of the contesting groups got the data and proceeded to investigate the fleet alone?
Yes. After all, what is that bunch of floating hulks to us? Just a dangerous place where we lost a scout boat and a dozen fine crewmen. We're not ancestor worshippers like those E.T. fanatics fighting over us, and we don't give a damn except intellectually whether the derelict fleet is a remnant from the days of progenitors, or even the returning progenitors themselves. It sure isn't worth dying over. If we've learned one thing in the last 200 years, it's that a little clan of newcomers like us Earth folk has got to duck out of the way when big boys like the Sorrow and Gubru get something up their snoots.
Dr. Metz's silvery hair waved as he bobbed his head for emphasis. A fizzing halo of effervescence collected amongst the strands. Crydike didn't want to go back to respecting Ignazio Metz, but when the man became passionate enough to drop his stuffy facade, he became almost likable. Unfortunately, Metz was fundamentally wrong. Crydike's harness clock chimed. He realized with a start how late it had become.
You make an interesting argument, Dr. Metz. I don't have time to go into it any further right now, but nothing will be decided until a full staff review by the ship's council. Does that sound fair?
Yes, I think so, although...
And speaking of the battle over Kithrop, I must go now to see what Takata Jim has to say.
He hadn't intended to spend so much time with Metz. He did not plan to miss his long-delayed exercise period. Metz seemed unwilling to let go.
Your mention of Takata Jim reminds me of something else I wanted to bring up, Captain. I'm concerned about feelings of social isolation expressed by some of the crewmen who happen to come from various experimental sub-breeds. They complain of ostracism and seem to be under discipline a disproportionate amount of the time.
You're referring to some of the Stenos, I assume?
Metz looked uncomfortable.
A colloquial term that seems to have caught on, although all Neofen are taxonomically tertiops amicus.
I have my jaws on the situation, Dr. Metz. Crydike no longer cared if he interrupted the mill. Subtle group dynamics are involved, and I am applying what I believe are effective techniques to maintain crew solidarity.
Only about a dozen of the Stenos showed disaffection. Krydyke suspected an infection of stress atavism, a decay of sapiency under fear and pressure. The supposed expert, Dr. Metz, seemed to think the majority of Streaker's crew was practicing racial discrimination.
"Are you implying that Takata Jim is also having problems?" Krydyke asked.
"Certainly not. He's a most impressive officer. Mention of his name reminded me because..."
Metz paused.
"Because he's a Stenos," Krydyke finished for him silently.
"Shall I tell Metz that I'm considering moving Hikahi into the vice captaincy? For all of Takata Jim's skill, his moody isolation is becoming a drag on crew morale. I cannot have that in my pod second." Krydyke sorely missed Lieutenant Yachapa Jean, who had died back at the shallow cluster.
"Dr. Metz, since you bring up the subject, I have noticed discrepancies between pre-launch psych profiles of certain members of the crew and their subsequent performance. I'm not a set of psychologists, per se, but in certain cases I am convinced the Fen did not belong on this ship in the first place. Have you a comment?"
Metz's face was blank.
"I'm not sure I know what you're talking about, Captain."
Krydyke's harness whirred as one arm snaked out to scratch an itch above his right eye.
"I have little to go on, but I think I'll want to invoke command privilege and look over your notes, strictly informally, of course. Please prepare them for..."
A tone interrupted Krydyke. It came from the comm link on his harness.
"Yes, speak," he commanded.
He listened for a few moments to a buzzing voice on his neural tap.
"Hold everything," he replied. "I'll be right up. Krydyke out."
He focused a burst of sonar at the sensitive plate by the door lock. The hatch hummed open.
"That was the bridge," he told Metz. "A scout has returned with a report from Tisht and Thomas Orley. I'm needed, but we will discuss these matters again, Doctor."
With two powerful fluke strokes, Krydyke was through the locked doors and on his way to the bridge. Ignacio Metz watched the captain go. "Krydyke suspects," he thought. "He suspects my special studies. I'll have to do something. But what?" These conditions of siege pressure were providing fantastic data, especially on the dolphins Metz had inveigled into Streaker's complement. But now things were starting to come apart. Some of his subjects were showing stress symptoms he had never expected. Now, in addition to worry about E.T. fanatics, he had to handle Krydyke's suspicions. It wouldn't be easy to put him off track. Metz appreciated genius when he saw it, especially in an uplifted dolphin. "If only he were one of mine," he thought of Krydyke. "If only I could take credit for that one."
Chapter 23. Jillian. The ships lay in space like serried rows of scattered beads, dimly reflecting the faint glow of the Milky Way. The nearest stars were the dim reddish oldsters of a small globular cluster, patient and barren remnants from the first epoch of star formation, devoid of planets or metals. Jillian contemplated the photograph, one of six that Streaker had innocently transmitted home from what had seemed an obscure and uninteresting gravitational tide pool, far off the beaten path. An eerie, silent armada, unresponsive to their every query. The Earthlings hadn't known what to make of it. The fleet of ghost ships had no place in the ordered structure of the five galaxies. How long had they gone unnoticed? Jillian put the holo aside and picked up another. It showed a close-up of one of the giant derelict ships, huge as a moon, pitted and ancient. It shimmered inside a faint lambency, a preservative field of unguessable properties. The aura had defied analysis. They could only tell that it was an intense probability field of unusual nature. In attempting to dock with one ghost ship at the outer reaches of the field, the crew of Streaker's gig somehow touched off a chain reaction. Brilliant lightning flashed between the ancient behemoth and the little scout boat. Lieutenant Yachapa Jean had reported that all the dolphins were experiencing intense visions and hallucinations. She tried to disengage, but in her disorientation she set off her stasis screens inside the strange field. The resultant explosion tore apart both the tiny earthship and the giant derelict. Jillian put down the photo and looked across the lab. Kirby lay enmeshed in his web of stasis, a silhouette untold billions of years old. After the disaster, Tom had gone out all alone and brought the mysterious relic in secret through one of Streaker's side locks. A prize of great cost, Jillian thought, as she contemplated the cadaver. We paid well for you, Herb. If only I could figure out what we bought. Herb was an enigma worthy of concerted research by the great institutes, not one solitary woman on a besieged starship far from home. It was frustrating, but someone had to make this effort. Somebody had to try to understand why they had been turned into hunted animals. With Tom gone and Krydike busy keeping the ship and crew functioning, the task was hers. Slowly, she was learning a thing or two about Herbie, enough to confirm that the corpse was very old, that it had the skeletal structure of a planet walker, and that the ship's micro-library still claimed that nothing like it had ever existed. She put her feet up onto the desk and pulled another photo from the stack. It clearly showed, through that shimmering probability field, a row of symbols etched into the side of a massive hull. "Open library," she pronounced. Of the four holoscreens on her desk, the one at the far left, with the rayed spiral glyph above it, came a light. "Sargasso file, symbols reference search, open and display changes." A terse column of text displayed in response against the wall to Jillian's left. The listing was dismayingly brief. "Subpersona, reference librarian, query mode," she said. The outline remained projected against the wall. Alongside it, a swirling pattern coalesced into the rayed spiral design. A low, calm voice intoned, "Reference librarian mode, may I help you?" "Is this all you've been able to come up with regarding those symbols on the side of that derelict ship?" "Affirmative." The voice was cool. The inflections were correct, but no attempt had been made to disguise the fact that it came from a minimal persona, a small corner of the shipboard library program. "I have searched my records for correlates with these symbols. You are well aware, of course, that I am a very small micro-branch, and that symbols are endlessly mutable in time. The outline gives all possible references I have found within the parameters you set." Jillian looked at the short list. It was hard to believe. Though incredibly small compared with planetary or sector branches, the ship's library contained the equivalent of all the books published on Earth until the late 21st century. Surely there had to be more correlates than this. "Ifni," she sighed. "Something has got half the fanatics in the galaxy stirred up. Maybe it's that picture of Herbie we sent back. Maybe it's these symbols. Which was it?" "I am not equipped to speculate," the program responded. "The question was rhetorical and not addressed to you anyway. I see you show a 30% correlation of five symbols with religious glyphs of the Abdicator Alliance. Give me an overview of the Abdicators." The voice shifted tone. Cultural Summary Mode. Abdicator is a term chosen from Anglic to represent one of the major philosophical groupings in galactic society. The Abdicator belief dates from the fabled Tarsia episode of the 15th Aeon, approximately 600 million years ago, a particularly violent time when the galactic institutes barely survived the ambitions of three powerful patron lines. Reference numbers 97ACF109T, 97ACG136T, and 97ACG986S. Two of these species were amongst the most potent and aggressive military powers in the history of the five linked galaxies. The third species was responsible for the introduction of several new techniques of spacecraft design, including the now standard. The library waxed into a highly technical discussion of hardware and manufacturing methods. Though interesting, it seemed hardly relevant. With her toe, she touched the skim button on her console, and the narration leaped ahead. The conquerors assumed an appellation which might be translated as the Lions. They managed to seize most of the transfer points and centers of power, and all the great libraries. For 20 million years, their grip appeared unassailable. The Lions engaged in unregulated population expansion and colonization, resulting in extinction of 8 of 10 pre-client races in the five galaxies at the time. The Tarsia helped bring about an end of this tyranny by summoning intervention by 6 ancient species previously thought to be extinct. These 6 joined forces with the Tarsia in a successful counterattack by galactic culture. Afterward, when the institutes were re-established, the Tarsia accompanied the mysterious defenders to an obscure oblivion. Jillian interrupted the flow of words.
Where did the 6 species that helped the rebels come from? Did you say they had been extinct?
The monitor voice returned. According to records of the time, they had been thought extinct. Do you want reference numbers?
No. Proceed.
Today most Sophants believe the 6 were racial remnants not yet finished stepping off into a later stage of evolution. Thus, the 6 might not have been extinct per se, but merely grown almost unrecognizable. They were still capable of taking an interest in the mundane affairs when matters became sufficiently severe. Do you wish me to refer you to articles on the natural passing modes of species?
No. Proceed. What do the abdicators say took place?
Abdicators believe that there are certain ethereal races which deign to take physical form from time to time, disguised in a seemingly normal pattern of uplift. These great ghosts are raised up as pre-clients, pass through indenture, and go on to become leading seniors without ever revealing their true nature. In emergencies, however, these super species can quickly intervene directly in the affairs of mortals. The progenitors are said to be the earliest, most aloof, and most powerful of these great ghosts. Naturally, this is profoundly different from the common progenitor legend that the eldest departed the home galaxy long ago, promising to return some day.
Stop!
The library fell silent at once. Jillian frowned as she thought about the phrase, "Naturally, this is profoundly different." Bull. The abdicator belief was just a variant of the same basic dogma, differing only slightly from other millennial legends of the return of the progenitors. The controversy reminded her of old-time religious conflicts on Earth, when adherents had performed frantic exegesis over the nature of Trinity, or the number of angels that could dance on the head of a pin. This particular frenzy over minor points of doctrine would be almost funny if the battle weren't going on right now a few thousand kilometers overhead. She jotted a reminder to try a cross-reference to the Hindu belief in the avatars of deities.
The similarity to abdicator tenants made her wonder why the library hadn't made the connection, at least as an analogy. Enough is enough. Nis, she called. The screen on the far right came alight. An abstract pattern of sparkling motes erupted into a sharply limited zone just above. As you know, Gillian Baskin, it is preferable that the library not know of my existence aboard this ship. I have taken the liberty of screening it so that it cannot observe our conversation. You wish to ask me something?
I certainly do. Were you listening to that report just now?
I listen to everything this ship's micro-branch does. It is my primary function here. Didn't Thomas Orley ever explain that to you?
Gillian restrained herself. Her foot was too close to the offending screen. She put it on the floor to remove temptation.
Nis, she asked evenly, why does the micro-branch library talk gibberish? The Timbrimy machine sighed anthropomorphically. Dr. Baskin, virtually every oxygen-breathing race but mankind has been weaned on a semantic which evolved down scores of patron-client links, all influenced by the library. The languages of Earth are strange and chaotic by galactic standards. The problems of converting galactic archives into your unconventional syntax are enormous.
I know that. The ETs wanted us to all learn Galactic 7 at the time of contact. We told them to take the idea and stick it.
Graphically put, instead, humanity applied immense resources to convert Earth's branch library to use colloquial Anglic, hiring Contin, Timbrimy, and others as consultants. But still there are problems. Are there not?
Gillian rubbed her eyes. This was getting nowhere. Why did Tom imagine this sarcastic machine was useful? Whenever she wanted a simple answer, it only asked questions.
The language problem has been their excuse for 2 centuries, she said. How much longer will they use it? Since contact, we've been studying language as it hasn't been studied in millions of years. We've tackled the intricacies of wolfling tongues like Anglic, English, Japanese, and taught dolphins and chimps to speak. We've even made some progress communicating with those strange creatures, the Solarians of Earth's sun. Yet the Library Institute still tells us it's our language that's at fault for all of these lousy correlations, these clumsily translated records. Hell, Tom and I can each speak 4 or 5 galactic tongues. It's not the language difference that's the trouble. There's something queer about the data we've been given.
The Nis hummed silently for a time. The sparkling motes coalesced and separated like 2 immiscible fluids merging and falling apart into droplets.
Dr. Baskin, haven't you just described the major reason for ships such as this one, which roam space hunting discrepancies in the library's records? And the very purpose of my existence, to catch the library in a lie, to find out if powerful patron races, as you would say, stack the deck against younger sophants such as Men and Timbrimy?
Then why don't you help me?
Gillian's heart raced. She gripped the edge of the desk and realized that frustration was close to overcoming her.
Why am I so fascinated with the human way of looking at things, Dr. Baskin?
The Nis asked. Its voice turned almost sympathetic.
My Timbrimy masters are unusually crafty. Their adaptability keeps them alive in a dangerous galaxy. Yet they too are trapped in the galactic mode of thinking. You Earthlings, from a fresh perspective, may see what they do not. The range of behaviors and beliefs among oxygen breathers is vast, yet the experience of man is virtually unique. Carefully uplifted client races never suffer through the errors made by your pre-contact
human nations. These errors have made you different."
That was true enough, Jillian knew. Blatant idiocies had been tried by early men and women, foolishness that would never have been considered by species aware of the laws of nature. Desperate superstitions had bred during the savage centuries. Styles of government, intrigues, philosophies were tested with abandon. It was almost as if orphan Earth had been a planetary laboratory upon which a series of senseless and bizarre experiments were tried. Illogical and shameful as they seemed in retrospect, those experiences enriched modern man. Few races have made so many mistakes in so short a time, or tried so many tentative solutions to hopeless problems. Earthling artists were sought out by many jaded ETs and paid well to spin tales no galactic would imagine. The Timbrimi particularly liked human fantasy novels with lots of dragons, ogres, and magic. The more the better. They thought them terrifyingly grotesque and vivid.
"I am not discouraged when you grow frustrated with the library," the Nis said. "I am glad. I learn from your frustration. You question things that all galactic society takes for granted." "Only secondarily am I here to help you, Mrs. Orley. Primarily I am here to observe how you suffer."
Jillian blinked. The machine's use of an ancient honorific had to have a purpose, as did its blatant attempt to make her angry. She sat still amid a flux of conflicting emotions.
"This is getting nowhere," she spat, "and it's making me crazy. I feel all cooped up."
The Nis sparkled without commenting. Jillian watched the motes spin and dance.
"You're suggesting we let it sit for a while, aren't you?"
she said at last.
"Both Timbrimi and humans possess preconscious selves. Perhaps we should both let matters lie in the dark for a time, and let our hidden parts mull things over."
Jillian nodded.
"I'm going to ask Krydike to send me to Hikahi's island. The Abos are important. After escape itself, I guess they're the most important thing."
"A normal moral view from the galactic standpoint, and therefore of little interest to me."
The Nis sounded bored already. The dazzling display coalesced into dark patterns of spinning lines. They whirled and converged, fell together into a tiny point, and disappeared. Jillian imagined she heard a faint pop as the Nis departed. When she reached Krydike on the comm line, the captain blinked at her.
"Jillian, is your psi working overtime? I was just calling you."
She sat up.
"Have you heard from Tom?"
"Yes, he's fine. He's asked me to send you on an errand. Can you come down here right away?"
"I'm on my way, Krydike."
She locked the door to her lab and hurried toward the bridge. Chapter 24 Galactics. Bay Chohuan could only rumble in amazement at the magnitude of the battle. How had the fanatics managed to gather such strength in so short a time? Bay's little Cynthian scout ship cruised down the ancient rocky jet stream left by a long-dead comet. The Castemony system was ablaze with bright flashes. Her screens showed the battle fleets as they merged into swirling knots all around her, scratching and killing and separating again. Alliances formed and dissolved whenever the parties seemed to sense an advantage. In violation of the codes of the Institute for Civilized Warfare, no quarter was being given. Bay was an experienced spy for the Cynthian Enclave, but she had never seen anything like this.
I was an observer at Paklathuthal when the clients of the J-81 Ek broke their indenture on the battlefield. I saw the Obeyer Alliance meet the abdicators in ritual war, but never have I seen such mindless slaughter. Have they no pride? No appreciation of the art of war?
Even as she watched, they saw the strongest of the alliances fall apart in a fiery betrayal as one flank fell upon the other. Bay snorted in disgust.
"Faithless fanatics," she muttered.
There was a chitter from the shelf to her left. A row of small pink eyes looked down upon her.
"Which of you said that?"
She glared at the little tarsier-like wazoon, each staring out the entrance hatch of its own little spy globe. The eyes blinked back at her. The wazoon snickered in amusement, but none of them answered her directly. Bayes sniffed.
"Well, you're right, of course. The fanatics have quick reactions on their side. They do not stop and consider, but dive right in, while we moderates must ponder before we act."
Especially the ever-cautious Cynthians, she thought. Earthlings are supposed to be our allies. Yet timidly we talk and consider, we protest to the impotent institutes, and send expendable scouts to spy upon the battle. The bazoon chattered a warning.
"I know," she snapped. "Don't you think I know my business? So there's a watcher probe up ahead. One of you go take care of it and don't bother me. Can't you see I'm busy?"
The eyes blinked at her. One pair vanished as the wazoon scuttled into its tiny ship and closed the hatch. In a moment, a small shudder passed through the scout as the probe departed. "Luck to you, small wazoon, fateful client," she thought. Feigning nonchalance, she watched as the tiny probe danced ahead amongst the planetoid debris, sneaking toward the watcher probe that lay in Bay's path. "One expendable scout," she thought bitterly. "The Timbrimi are fighting for their lives. Earth is besieged, half her colonies taken, and still we Cynthians wait and watch, watch and wait, sending only me and my team to observe." A small flame burned suddenly, casting stark shadows through the asteroid field. The wazoon let out a low groan of mourning, stopping quickly when Bay looked their way.
"Do not hide your feelings from me, my brave wazoon," she murmured. "You are clients and brave warriors, not slaves. Mourn your colleague who died so well for us."
She thought about her own cool, careful people, amongst whom she always felt a stranger.
"Feel,"
she insisted, surprised by her own vehemence.
"There is no shame in caring, my little wazoon. In this you may be greater than your patron race, when you are grown up and on your own."
Bay piloted closer to the water world, where the battle raged, feeling more akin to her little client comrades than to her own ever-cautious race. Chapter 25. Thomas Orley. Orley looked upon his treasure, a thing he had sought for 12 years. It appeared to be intact, the first of its kind ever to fall into human hands. Only twice had micro-branch libraries, designed for other races, been captured by human crews from ships defeated in skirmishes over the last 200 years. In each case, the repositories were damaged. Attempts to study them were informative, but one mistake or another always caused the semi-intelligent machines to self-destruct. This was the first ever recovered from a warship of a powerful galactic patron race, and the first taken since certain Timbrimi had joined in this clandestine research. The unit was a beige box, about 3 meters by 2 by 1, with simple optical access ports. Halfway along one side was the rayed spiral symbol of the library. It was lashed to a cargo sled along with other booty, including 3 probability coils, undamaged and irreplaceable. Anna Suessi would ride back to Streaker, protecting those as a mother hen her eggs. Only when he saw them safely in Emerson Dionides' hands would he turn around to come back here. Tom wrote routing instructions on a wax board. With any luck, the crew back at Streaker would turn the micro-branch unit over to Krydike or Jillian without undue attention. He adhered the shipping slip so that it covered the library glyph. Not that his interest in a captured micro-branch was particularly secret. The crew here had helped him pry it from the Thenanin ship. But the fewer who knew the details, the better, especially if they should ever be captured. If his instructions were followed, the unit would be plugged into the comm in his own cabin, to outward appearances a normal communication screen. He imagined the Nis would be impressed. Tom wished he could be there when the Timbrimi machine found out what it suddenly had access to. The smug thing would probably be speechless for half a day. He hoped it wouldn't be too stunned. He wanted something from it right away. Suessi was already asleep, tethered to his precious salvage. Tom made sure the instructions were well secured. Then he swam up toward the sheer outcrop of rock overlooking the wrecked alien starship. Neo-Fen swarmed over the hulk, making detailed measurements from without and within. At word from Krydike, charges would be set off, beginning a process that would leave the giant battleship's core a reamed and empty cavity. By now the scout they had sent back should have reached Streaker with its initial report, and a sled should already be returning down the new shortcut they had found. Bringing a monofilament intercom line from home, it ought to meet the salvage sled about halfway. All this assumed home was still there. Tom guessed the battle still raged above Kithrop. Space war was a slow thing, especially as practiced by the long-viewed galactics. They might still be at it in a year or two, though he doubted it. That much time would allow reinforcements to arrive and produce a war of attrition. It was unlikely the fanatic alliances would let things come to that pass. In any event, Streaker's crew had to act as if the war were about to end any day now. So long as confusion reigned above, they still had a chance. Tom went over his plan again, and came to the same conclusion. He had no other choice. There were three conceivable ways they might escape the trap they were in. Rescue, negotiation, and trickery. Rescue was a nice image, but Earth herself didn't have the strength to come and deliver them. Together with her allies, she could barely match one of the pseudo-religious factions in the battle over Kithrop. The Galactic Institutes might intervene. What law there was demanded that Streaker report directly to them. Problem was, the Institutes had little power of their own. Like the feeble versions of world government Earth had almost died of in the 20th century, they relied on mass opinion and volunteer levies. The majority moderates might finally decide that Streaker's discovery should be shared by all, but Tom figured it would take years for the necessary alliances to form. Negotiation seemed as faint a hope as rescue. In any event, Krydike had Jillian and Hikaki and Metz to help him if it ever came to haggling with a victor in the space battle. They didn't need Tom for that. That left clever schemes and subtle deceptions, finding a way to thwart the enemy when rescue and negotiation fail. That's my job. The ocean was deeper and darker here than 50 kilometers to the east, where strings of metal mounds grew in hilly shallows along the edges of a thin crustal plate. In the area where Hikahi's party had been rescued, the water was metal-enriched, by a chain of semi-active volcanoes. There were no true metal mounds in this area, and the long-dead volcanic islands were worn down to the water's surface. When he looked away from the crumpled Thenanin wreck and the trail of havoc it had left before coming to rest, Tom found the scenery restful, its beauty calming. drifting dark yellow fronds of dangle vine waving like corn silk from the surface, reminded him of the color of Jillian's hair. Orly hummed to himself a melody few other human beings could attempt. Small gene-crafted sinuses reverberated under his skull, sending a low refrain into the water around him. In sleep, your caring touches me, where, waking, I let it not. In distance, I will call to you and touch you as you sleep. Of course, Jillian couldn't actually hear his gift poem. His own psi powers were quite modest. Still, she might pick up a hint. Other things she had done had surprised him more. The dolphin escort gathered at the sled. Suessi had awakened and was checking the lashings with Lieutenant Tisht. Tom launched himself from his aerie toward the group. Tisht saw him and took a quick breath from an air dome before swimming up to meet him halfway.
"I wish you would reconsider doing this," she implored when they met. "I'll be frank. Your presence is good for morale. If you were lost, it would be a blow."
Tom smiled and put a hand on her flank. He had already come to terms with his poor chances of returning. "I don't see any other way, Tisht. All the other parts of my plan can be handled by others, but I'm the only one who can bait the hook. You know that." "Besides," he grinned, "Krydike will have one more chance to call me back if he doesn't like the plan. I ask that he send Jillian to meet me at Hikahi's Island with the glider and the supplies I need. If she tells me his answer is no, I'll be back at the ship before you." Tisht looked away.
"I doubt he'll say no,"
she whistled low and almost inaudibly.
What do you mean?"
Evasively, Tisht answered in trinary.
"Krydike leads us, is our master, yet we imagine secret orders."
Tom sighed. There it was again, the suspicion that Earth would never let the first dolphin-commanded vessel go out without disguised human supervision. Naturally, most of the rumors centered around himself. It was bothersome, because Krydike was an excellent captain. Also, it detracted from one of the purposes of the mission, to make a demonstration that would boost Neo-Finn self-confidence for a generation. "Then, in my leaving, learn a lesson. Aboard Streaker is your captain." Tisht must have been running low on the breath she had taken at the sled's air dome. Bubbles leaked from her blowmouth. Still, she looked back at him resignedly and spoke in Anglic.
"All right. After Suessi leaves, we'll get you on your way. We'll continue working here until we get orders from Krydike."
"Good," Tom nodded. "And you still approve of the rest of the plan?" Tisht turned away, her eyes recessed.
"Kanik and Logic join to sing its tune. The plan is all between us and our doom. We'll all do our part."
Tom reached over and hugged her. "I know we can count on you, you sweet old fish catcher. I'm not worried at all. Now, let's say goodbye to Hannah so I can be on my way. I don't want Jill to get to the island before me." He dove toward the sled, but Tisht remained behind for a moment. Although the air in her lungs was growing stale, she lay still, watching him swim away. Her sonar click swept over him as he descended. She caressed him with her hearing and sang a quiet requiem.
"They cast their nets to catch us, those of Iki, yet you are there to cut the nets. Good walker, always, you cut the nets, though they'll take in payment your life."
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 4, Star Tide Rising, Cassette 5.
Chapter 26. Krydike. The most formal Anglic, spoken carefully by a Neo-Dolphin, would be difficult for a human raised only in man English to understand. The syntax and many root words were the same, but a pre-spaceflight Londoner would have found the sounds as strange as the voices that spoke them. The dolphin's modified blowhole provided whistles, squawks, vowels, and a few consonants. Sonar clicks and many other sounds came from complex resonant cavities inside the skull. In speech, these separate contributions were sometimes in phase and sometimes not. Even at the best of times, there were stretched sibilants, stuttered T's, and groaned vowels. Speech was an art. Trinary was for relaxation, for imagery and personal matters. It replaced and greatly expanded on primal dolphin. But Anglic linked the neo-dolphin to the world of cause and effect. Anglic was a language of compromise between the vocal abilities of the two races, between the hands and fire world of men and the drifting legends of the whale dream. Speaking it, a neo-dolphin could equal most humans in analytic thought, consider past and future, make schemes, use tools, and fight wars. Some thoughtful humans wondered if giving the cetacean Anglic had really been much of a favor after all. Two neo-dolphins alone together might speak Anglic for concentration, but not care if the sounds resembled English words. They would drift into frequencies beyond human hearing, and consonants would virtually disappear. Kinnik allowed this. It was the semantics that counted. If the grammar, the two-level logic, the time orientation were Anglic, pragmatic results were all that mattered. When Crydike took Hikahi's report, he purposely spoke a very relaxed form of Finn Anglic. By example, he wanted to say that what went on here was private. He listened to her while he took the kinks out of his body, diving and racing back and forth across the exercise pool. Hikahi recited her report on the planetology meeting, enjoying the sweet smell of real air in her main lungs. Occasionally she paused and sped alongside him for a stretch before continuing. Right now, her words sounded nothing like human speech, but a very good voice writer could have transcribed them.
He feels very strongly about it, Captain. In fact, Charlie suggests that we should leave a small study team here with the longboat if Streaker tries to escape. Even Brukida is tempted by the idea. I was a bit stunned.
Crydike passed in front of her. He burst out a quick question. What would they do if we left them behind and we were then captured? He dove back underwater and sped toward the far wall.
Charlie thinks he and a detached team could be declared non-combatants, and the Studman Sawat group out on the island as well. He says there are precedents. That way, whether we get away or not, part of the mission is preserved.
The exercise room was in Streaker's centrifugal ring, 10 degrees up the side of the wheel. The walls were canted, and Crydike had to watch out for shallows in the pool's port side. A cluster of balls, rings, and complex toys floated to starboard. Crydike felt much better. The frustration which had built when he listened to Tom Orley's message had abated. He could put aside, for a while, the depression he felt when he agreed to the man's plan. All that remained was to get the formal advice of the ship's council. He prayed they'd come up with a better idea, though he doubted they would. Crydike swam quickly under a cluster of balls and shot out of the water. He spun as he sailed through the air and landed on his back with a splash. He did a flip underwater, then rose above the surface on his churning tail. Breathing heavily, he regarded Hikahi with one eye.
"I've considered the idea already," he said. "We could leave Metz and his records, too. Getting him off our tails would be worth 30 herring and an anchovy dessert."
He settled back down into the water.
"Too bad the solution is immoral and impractical."
Hikahi looked puzzled, trying to figure his meaning.
"Think,"
he asked his lieutenant.
Declaring non-combatants might work if we are killed or captured, but what if we escape and draw our E.T. friends chasing after us?
Ikaki's jaw dropped open slightly, a borrowed human mannerism.
Of course, I hear it. Gethsemane is so very isolated, there are only a few routes in and out. The longboat probably wouldn't make it back to civilization all alone.
Which would mean...
They would become castaways on a deadly planet, with minimal medical facilities. Forgive my lack of foresight.
She turned slightly, presenting her left ventral fin. It was a civilized version of an ancient gesture of submission, such as a human student's sheepish bowed head to his teacher. With luck, Ikaki would someday command ships far greater than Streaker. The captain and teacher within him was pleased with her combination of modesty and cleverness.
Well, we'll take their idea under advisement in case we have to adopt the plan quickly. See to stocking the longboat. Put a guard on it, too.
They both knew that it was a bad sign when security precautions had to be taken within as well as without. A brightly striped rubber ring floated past them. Kraidaki felt an urge to chase it, as he wanted to push Ikaki into a corner and nuzzle her until... He shook himself.
As for further tectonic research, he said, that's out of the question. Gillian Baskin has left for your island to take supplies to Orly and to help Sudman study the aboriginals. She can bring back rock samples for Charlie. That'll have to satisfy him. The rest of us will be busy as soon as Suessi gets back here with those spare parts.
Suessi's sure he found what we need at the wreck?
Fairly certain.
This new plan means we'll have to move Streaker. Turning on our engines may give us away, but I guess there's no choice. I'll get started on a plan to move the ship.
Kraidaki realized this was getting him nowhere. A few hours remained, at most, until Suessi arrived, and here he was talking to Ikaki in Anglic, forcing her to think rigidly and carefully. No wonder he was getting no hint, no body language, no suggestion that an advance might be welcomed or rejected. He answered in trinary. We'll only move her below water, to the crashed ship, empty, waiting. Soon, while battles rack the blackness, filling space with squid-like racket, at a time when Orly, net-bane far away, does make distraction far away, does truth decipher, drawing sharks to make us safer. Ikaki stared. This was the first time she had heard about that part of the plan. Like many females aboard, Ikaki had a platonic passion for Thomas Orly. I should have broken the news more gently, or better yet, waited. Her eyes blinked once, twice, then closed. She sank slowly, and from her forehead came a faint keening. Kraidaki envied humans their enfolding arms. He dropped alongside to touch her with his bottle-shaped rostrum. Do not grieve for strong-eyed flyer. Orly's song shall by whales be sung. Ikaki replied sadly.
I, Ikaki, honor Orly, honor captain, honor crewmates. Deeds are done still for one I suffer, for Jill Baskin, dear life cleaner, for her loss and body sorrow.
Shamed, Kraidaki felt an enclosing shroud of melancholy fall around him. He shut his own eyes, and the waters echoed back to him a shared sadness. For a long time they lay side by side, rising to breathe, then settling once more below. Kraidaki's thoughts were far away when he finally felt Ikaki drift away. But then she was back, rubbing gently against his side, and then nibbling tenderly with sharp, small teeth. Almost against his will, at first, Krydike felt his enthusiasm begin to return. He rolled over to his side and let out a long sigh of bubbles as her nuzzling became more provocative. The water began to taste happier then, as Hikahi crooned a familiar song taken from one of the oldest of primal signals. It seemed to say, among other things, "Life goes on." Chapter 27 The Island. The night was quiet. Kithrop's many small moons stirred low tides against metal cliffs 100 meters away. Ever-present winds driven without break across the planet ocean tugged at trees and ruffled the foliage. Still, compared to what they had known for months, the silence was heavy. There were none of the ubiquitous machine sounds which had followed them everywhere from Earth, the unceasing whirs and clicks of mechanical function, or the occasional smoking crackle of failure. The squeaking, groaning drone of dolphin conversation was gone, too. Even Kipiru and Saut were absent. At night, the two dolphins accompanied the Kithrop aboriginals in their nocturnal sea hunt. The surface of the metal mound was almost too quiet. The few sounds seemed to carry forever. The sea, a distant rumble of some faraway volcano. There was a gentle moan in the night, followed by a very quiet, gasping cry. "They're at it again," Denny sighed, not particularly caring if Toshio heard her. The sounds came from the clearing at the southern point of the island. The third and fourth humans on the metal mound had tried to find privacy as far from the Abo village and the tunnel pool as possible. Denny wished they could have gone even farther. There was laughter, faint but clear. "I've never heard anything like it," she sighed. Toshio blushed and fed another stick to the fire. The couple in the next clearing deserved their privacy. He considered pointing this out to Denny. "I swear, they're like minks," Denny said, intending to sound sardonic and mock envious, but it came out just a little bitter. Against his better judgment, Toshio said, "Denny, we all know humans are among the sexual athletes of the galaxy, though some of our clients give us a run for it."
"What do you mean by that?"
Denny looked at him sharply. Toshio poked a stick into the fire. That had been a pretty brash thing to say. He felt a trifle emboldened by the night and the desire to break the tension by the fire.
"Well, there's a line in an old play. Why, your dolphin was not lustier." Shakespeare wasn't the first to compare the two horniest of the brainy mammals, you know. I don't suppose anyone's come up with a scale to measure it, but I'd have to wonder if it weren't a prerequisite for intelligence. Of course, that's only one of the possibilities if you take what the Galactics say about uplift into account." He rambled on, slowly drawing away from incitement, noticing how Denny came this close to blowing her cool before she turned and looked away. He'd done it. He had played a round and won it. It was a minor victory in a game he had wondered if he would ever get to play. The art of teasing had always been a one-sided affair to Toshio, and he'd always had the short end. To get the best of an attractive older woman by dint of clever conversation and character insight was a coup. He didn't think he was being cruel, though a genteel cruelty did seem to be part of the game. All he knew for certain was that this was one way to get Denny Sudman to treat him less like a child. If some of the easy mutual liking they'd had before had to suffer for it, that was too bad. Much as he didn't care for Saut, Toshio was glad the Finn had provided the lever he needed to pry a chink in Denny's armor. He was about to try out another bon mot when Denny cut in. "I'm sorry, Tosh. I'd love to hear the rest, but I'm going to bed. We have a busy day tomorrow, launching Tom's glider, showing Jillian the Kiqui, and experimenting with that damned robot for Charlie. I'd suggest you get some sleep, too. She turned to wrap herself in her sleeping bag at the far end of the camp near the watchwards.
Yeah, Toshio said, perhaps a bit too heartily.
I'll do that in a bit, Denny. Good night, pleasant dreams. She was silent with her back to the tiny glow from the fire. Toshio couldn't tell if she was asleep or awake. I wish we humans were better at psi, he thought. They say telepathy has its drawbacks, but it would sure be nice to know what's going on in another person's head sometimes. It'd take away a lot of the anxiety if I knew what she was thinking, even if I found out she just thought I was a nervy kid. He looked up at the patchy sky overhead. Through long, ragged openings in the clouds, he could see stars. In two places, there were nubiculi in the sky that hadn't been there the night before, signs of a battle still raging. The tiny false nebulae glowed in every visible color, and probably in other bands than light. Toshio let a fistful of metallosilicate dirt sift through his fingers onto the coals. Falling sparkles of metal winked at him like incandescent confetti, like winking stars. He dusted off his hands and turned to crawl into his own sleeping roll. He lay there, eyes closed, reluctant to watch the stars or to dissect the pros and cons of his behavior. Instead, he listened to the wind and surf sounds of the night. They were rhythmic and calming, like a lullaby, like the seas of home. Except once in a while, he thought he could pick up on the edge of hearing, sighs and soft laughter coming from the south. They were sounds of complex happiness that filled him with a sad longing. "They're at it again," he sighed to himself. "I swear, I've never heard anything like it." The humid air kept their perspiration slick upon them. Jillian licked the mustache of tear-like salt off her upper lip, the same way Tom cleaned some of the sheen off her breasts. The wetness of his mouth cooled on her aureoles and nipples when he took his mouth away. She gasped and grabbed the wavy hair at the back of his head, where his slightly balding vanity feared no tugging. He responded with mock biting that sent shivers to her calves, thighs, and lower back. Jillian locked her heel behind his knee and levered her pelvis up against his. Her breath whistled softly as he lifted his head and met her eyes.
"I thought what I was doing was after play," he whispered a little hoarsely. He made a show of wiping his forehead. "You should warn me when I cross over the line and start promising what I can't deliver."
He took her hand and kissed its palm and the inside of her wrist. Jillian ran her fingers along his cheek to touch, feather light, his jaw, throat, and shoulder. She took sparse clumps of chest hair and pulled playfully. She purred, not like a house cat, but with the feral rumble of a leopardess.
"Whenever you're ready, love. I can wait. You may be the illegitimate son of a fecund test tube, but I know you better than your planners ever did. You have resources they never imagined."
Tom was about to say that, planners or no planners, he was the quite legitimate son of May and Bruce Orley of Minnesota State, Confederacy of Earth. But then he noticed the liquid welling in her eyes. Her words were rough, light, and teasing. But her grip on his chest hair only tightened as she looked up at his face, eyes roaming, as if memorizing every feature. Tom felt suddenly confused. He wanted to be close to Jillian on their last night together. How could they be any closer than they were right now? His body pressed against hers, and her warm breath filled his nostrils. He looked away, feeling somehow he was letting her down. Then he felt it. A tender stroking that seemed to strive against a locked and heavy feeling inside his own head. It was a soft,
pressure that would not go away. He realized that the thing fighting it was himself. "I'm leaving tomorrow," he thought. They had argued over who would be the one to go, and he had won. But it was bitter. He closed his eyes. "I've cut her off from me. I may never come back, and I've cut off the deepest part of me." Suddenly, Tom felt very strange and small, as if he were stranded in a dangerous place, the sole barrier between his loved ones and terrible foes. Not a superhero, but only a man, outnumbered and about to gamble all he had. As if he were himself. He opened his eyes as he felt a touch on his face. He pressed his cheek against her hand. There were still tears in her eyes, but also the beginnings of a smile.
"Silly boy," he said. "You can never leave me. Haven't you realized that by now? I'll be with you and you'll come back to me."
He shook his head in wonder.
"Jill,
He started to speak, but his mouth was stopped as she pulled him down to kiss him hungrily. Her lips were hot and tender upon his, crosswise. The fingers of her right hand did insightful things. Still and all, it was the heady, sweet smell of her that made him realize that she had been right about him once again. Part 3. Dissonance. Animals are molded by natural forces they do not comprehend. To their minds, there is no past and no future. There is only the everlasting present of a single generation, its trails in the forest, its hidden pathways in the air and in the sea. There is nothing in the universe more alone than man. He has entered into the strange world of history. Lauren Isley. Chapter 28. Sout. All night he had followed them. Toward morning, Sout felt he was beginning to understand. With the dawn, the Kikwi left their nocturnal hunting grounds and swam toward the safety of their island. They stowed their woven nets and traps in hidden coral clefts, took their crude spears, and hurried from the growing light. With daytime, the killer vines would become active, and other dangers as well. By day, the Kikwi could forage the forests atop the metal islands, seeking nuts and small animals in the thick foliage. Underwater, the Kikwi looked like green pufferfish, with short, web-handed arms and flippered legs. A pair of almost prehensile ventral fins helped them maneuver. Strong kicking legs left their hands free to carry burdens. Around each head, a fin-line crest of wafer-thin flagelli waved, collecting dissolved oxygen to supplement each Kikwi's distended air sac. The hunter-gatherers pulled two nets full of bright, crab-like sea creatures, like multicolored metal sculptures in the mesh. The Kikwi sang a song of flutters and squawks and yelps. Sout listened as they squeaked to one another, their tiny vocabulary hardly more than a series of vocalized signals coordinating their movements. Each time a few Kikwi rose to the surface for air, the act was accompanied by a chain of complex twitters. The natives took little notice of the alien creatures that followed them. Sout kept his distance, careful not to interfere. They knew he was here, of course. Now and then the younger Kikwi would cast suspicious sonar squirts his way. Strangely, the older hunter seemed to accept him completely. Sout looked up at the growing light with relief. In spite of the darkness, he had kept his own sonar down to a minimum all night to keep from intimidating the natives. He had felt almost blind and a little panicky when he almost blundered into something. Or something almost blundered into him. Still, it had been worthwhile.
He felt he had a pretty good grasp of their language now. The signal structure, like primal Delphin, was based on a hierarchical herd and the tempo of the breathing cycle. Its cause and effect logic was a bit more complicated than primal, no doubt due to hands and tool use. Look, we well hunt. Hunt, hunted, well. Careful, careful, opportunistic. Eat, eat well, will eat. Not eaten, no. Die above water, not in. Based on semantic ability alone, these creatures seemed less ripe for uplift than fallow earth dolphins had been. Others, biased toward tool-using ability, might disagree. Of course, the fact that they had hands probably meant the Kikwi would never be particularly good poets. Still, some of their braggadocio had a certain charm. The straps of Sout's harness chafed as he rose for breath. In spite of its light weight, streamlined design, he wished he could get rid of the damn thing. Of course, these waters were dangerous, and he might need its protection. Also, Kipiru was out there somewhere, staying out of the way as requested, but listening nonetheless. Kipiru would chew Sout's dorsal fin down to the backbone if he caught him without his harness. Unlike the ultra-technical Fen of Streaker's crew, Sout was uncomfortable with devices. He didn't mind computers, some of which could talk, and which helped him speak to other races, but implements for the moving, shaping, or killing of objects, these were unnatural things which he wished he could do without. He hated the two nubby little fingers at the tips of each of his pectoral fins, which they said would someday lead to full hands for his species. They were unaesthetic. He also resented the changes made to dolphin lungs, making them more resistant to land-based diseases and adapting parts to breathing oxywater. Natural cetaceans needed no such mutations. Fallow Stenos bridonensis and Tursiops truncatus dolphins, left untouched by the gene crafters, could outswim any of the Amicus breed almost any time. He was ambivalent to the expanded visual sense, bought at the cost of gray matter once dedicated to sound alone. Sout rose again to breathe, then submerged, keeping pace with the aboriginals. His own line represented a drive to emphasize language ability rather than tool use. It seemed to him a more natural extension of dolphin nature than all this crashing about in starships, pretending to be spacemen and engineers. That was one reason he had refused to go along in the spaceboat to help scout the derelict fleet back at the shallow cluster. Even had there been anything or anyone left to talk to, for which there'd been no evidence, he wasn't about to poke around supported only by a gang of inept clients. For Streaker to try to deal alone with the derelict fleet was like a group of children playing with a live bomb. His actions had won contempt from the crew, even though he had been vindicated by the disastrous loss of the captain's gig. Their contempt didn't matter, Sout reminded himself. He was a civilian. As long as he did his job, he didn't have to explain himself. Nor did disapproving clicks over his pursuit of Denny Sudman bother him. Long before uplift, male dolphins had been fresh with women researchers. It's a long-standing tradition, he rationalized. Whatever was good enough for horny old Flipper is good enough for his brainy descendant. One of the things he hated about Anglic patterns of thought was this need to self-justify. Men were always asking, why? What did it matter, why? There were other ways than the human way of looking at things. Any whale would tell you. The Kikwi chittered excitedly as they swam toward the eastern end of their own island, preparing to hoist their catch up a crevice in the leeward seawall. Sout felt the sweep of sonar like a passing searchlight. Kipiru approached from the north to escort him back to the Earthling encampment.
Sout flicked up to the surface. He tilted his head to look out on the new day. The sun rose behind a bank of haze in the east, and the wind carried a whisper of rain on the way. A metal taint seemed to stain the air, reminding him of their deadly predicament on Kithrop. No doubt Crydike and his engineers were trying to jury-rig a scheme to get out of this mess. Their plan would no doubt be frightfully bold and clever, and get them all killed. Wasn't it obvious that neophytes at the game of making and conquering couldn't thwart the Galactics, who had been at it for eons? The humans had his loyalty, of course, but he knew them for what they were. Clumsy wolflings, struggling to survive in a dangerously reactionary galaxy. There was an old dolphin saying, "All humans are engineers, and all engineers are humans." It was cute, but patently a lie. Kipiru broke surface beside him. Sal blew quietly, his breath condensing into spray. He lay watching the sunrise until Kipuru's patience wore thin.
"It's daylight, Sal. We shouldn't be out here. We've got to report, and I want food and rest."
Sal affected the role of an absent-minded scientist, as if pulled from thoughts deeper than Kipiru might ever understand.
"What? Oh, yes. Of course, pilot. By all means, I've very interesting data to report. You know, I think I've cracked their language."
"How nice."
Kipiru's reply was semantically Anglic and phonemically a squawk. He dove and headed for the cave entrance. Sout winced at the pilot's sarcasm, but he was unrepentant. "Maybe I've time to finish a few suggestive limericks to intersperse in my report to Denny," he thought. "It's too bad she stays up on the bank of the pool. Maybe today she'll relent." When they got to the bottom of the former drill tree shaft, now lit by a small phosphor bulb, Sout noticed that someone had taken both sleds out of the passage and moored them in the cavern below. But at least one sled was always supposed to be in the pool in case Denny and Toshio had to escape quickly. He hurried after Kipiru up the narrow vertical tunnel. There were two more sleds in the pool at the top. Someone must have arrived from the ship during the night. Toshio and Denny were already down by the water, talking to Kipiru. Sout eyed Denny speculatively, but decided not to start in. "This evening, I'll try to get her to join me in the water. I'll think up a pretext, maybe something to do with the mechanics of the drill tree route. It probably won't work, but the attempt should be fun." Sout spy-hopped, churning his tail to rise up and look about the poolside clearing. The thick brush parted to the south, and two men, one female and one male, approached. Gillian Baskin knelt by the poolside and whistled a trinary welcome. "Constant Kipiru, solid as surf rock, orca defier, chameleon Sout, ever adaptable, ever so manlike, under dark squalls, I'd recognize you two. Study in opposites." Kipiru answered in Anglic, a pathetically unoriginal,
"Good to see you, Gillian. You too, Tom.
Sout settled down, uncomfortably aware that he had a reputation to live up to. Unlike Kipiru, he would have to come up with a greeting that matched Gillian's. He would rather have gone someplace to think about Jillian's remark, especially that part about being ever so manlike. Was that a compliment, or was there a touch of pity in Jillian's upper register when she had whistled it? Orly stood quietly next to Gillian. Sout felt as if the man were seeing through him. Sout drew a breath. "Look here, a monogamous miracle.
a pair of lovers, silhouetted against the wide sky. Jillian clapped her hands and laughed. Orly smiled briefly, but apparently had things on his mind.
"I'm glad you two Finns are back," he said. "Jillian and I arrived last night, she from Streaker and I from the site where Toshio's tsunami ship crashed. Jill brought you folks a monofilament cable so you can stay in touch with the ship. She'll work with you for a few days on this vital matter of the Kikwi. Also, I understand there are some folks back at the ship who'd like to ask you to collect some data for them. Is that right, Jillian?" The blonde woman nodded. Word of Charlie Dart's demands had not delighted Toshio and Denny. Orly continued, "Jill's other purpose in coming here was to deliver some gear to me. I have to go away this morning. I'll be using a solar glider." Kipiru sucked air. He started to object, but Orly raised a hand. "I know, it's risky, but there's an experiment I have to try in order to see if the escape plan we've put together will work. And since you people are the only ones available, I'm going to have to ask for your help." Sout's tail thrashed under the water. He clamped down to hide his feelings, but it was hard. So hard. So they were truly going to try to escape. He had hoped for better from Orly and Baskin. They were intelligent and experienced, almost mythical agents of the Terrigan's Council. Survivors. Now they were talking madness and expected him to help. Didn't they realize what they were up against? He swam up next to Kipiru, wearing the mask of a faithful, attentive client. But inside, he felt turmoil as he listened to the crazy plan that was supposed to save them from the bug-eyed monsters. Chapter 29 Takata Jim. The ship's council meeting was a disaster. "It is worse than I thought," the vice-captain sighed. "They planned deception to fool deceivers, and veils to cover whales." Katha John tossed his great blunt head in agreement. "I hear the code word for this project is the Trojan Seahorse. What does that mean?" "It's a literary illusion," Takata Jim replied. He wondered where the bosun had gone to school. "I'll explain some other time. Right now, I must think. There must be another way than this suicide plan Crydike and Orly have devised."
"The captain didn't listen?"
"Oh, he's very polite. Blowfish Metz swam in my wake, point by point, and Crydike listened so nicely to both of us. The meeting lasted 4 hours, but the captain decided to go with Orly's scheme anyway. The Baskin femme has already left with supplies for him." The two Stenos drifted quietly for a long moment. Katha John waited for the vice-captain. Takata Jim's tail slashed. "Why won't Crydike even consider broadcasting the location of our find and have done with it? Instead, he and Orly want to try to trick Sophants who have been trapping each other for millions of years. We'll be fried. Compared with this plan, even your idea of blasting forth with all guns blazing is better. At least we'd be able to maneuver."
"I only offer a glorious alternative to his mad venture," Katha John said. "But I would go with your plan. Think. If we were the ones to find a way to save the ship and crew, would not the benefits go beyond simply preserving our lives?"
Takata Jim shook his head. "If I were in command, perhaps, but we are led by this mad, honor-bound genius who will only guide us to doom." He turned away, deep in his thoughts, and swam silently down the corridor to his quarters. Katha John's eyes narrowed as they followed the vice-captain. Bubbles from his blow mouth came out in tiny rhythmic pops. Chapter 30 Aki. It wasn't fair. Almost everybody who counted had been allowed to go with Hikahi to go join the crew working on the Thenanin wreck. The repairs to Streaker were nearly completed, and he was still stuck here, where nothing important was happening at all. Aki drifted at his study station under an air dome near the top of the central bay. Bubbles from below passed unhindered through the pages of a holotext displayed in front of him. Of all the dumb ideas, making him study astrogation while the ship was stuck at the bottom of an ocean. He tried to concentrate on the subtleties of wormhole navigation, but his mind wandered. He got to thinking about Toshio. How long ago had it been since the two of them had time to pull off a decent prank? It must have been over a month since they'd stolen Brukita's glasses and replaced them with Fresnel lenses. I sure hope Toshio's okay. But at least he's doing something. Why did Crydike insist I stay here when they need every decent engineer out of the wreck? Aki tried one more time to focus on the text, but was distracted by a sound. He looked down toward a noisy altercation at one of the food stations. Two Fen were taking turns swatting at each other with their flukes, while a circle of others watched. Aki backed out of the air dome and dove toward the disturbance. "Stop this!" he shouted. "Cut it out now!" He struck out with his own flukes to knock Zapata and Shrika Joe apart. The observers backed away a little, but the combatants ignored him. They bit and flailed at each other. A kicking fluke struck Aki in the chest, sending him spinning. Aki gulped to catch his breath. How did they find the energy to fight in oxy water? He swam up to one of the observers. "Piktau! Piktau!" He bit the fin on his flank and assumed dominant stance as Piktau whirled angrily. It wasn't easy to face him down. Aki felt very young. But Crydike had taught him what to do. When a fin reverts, make him focus. "Piktau! Stop listening to them and use your eyes! Look at me! As a ship's officer, I order you to help me break up this fight." The glazed expression faded from Piktau's face. He nodded. "Aye, sir." Aki was amazed by the fellow's dullness. Drops of blood diffused into a pink stain as the combatants slowed down, trading blows, their gill lungs gasping for breath. Aki collected three more crew fen, swatting and shouting to get them focused. Then he moved in. He got the stenos and the cook separated at last and led them under guard toward sickbay. Dr. McEnany could keep them isolated until he reported this to the captain. Aki glanced up and noticed the bosun, Kathan John, pass by. The giant petty officer didn't even offer to help. He probably watched the whole thing, Aki thought bitterly. Kathan John wouldn't have needed to cajole the onlookers. He could have intimidated the brawlers with a growl. Kathan John was headed swiftly for the outlock, his expression intent. Aki sighed. Okay, maybe Crydike had his reasons for keeping me around after all. Now that Hikahi has left with the engineers, he needs help taking care of the dregs that are still aboard Streaker. Aki nosed Shrika Joe to keep him moving. The steno squawked an almost primal curse, but obeyed. "At least I've got an excuse not to study astrogation," Aki thought sardonically.
This ends Side 1 of Cassette 5. Cassette 5, Side 2.
Chapter 31 Suessi.
"No, stop it. Back off and try it again, this time more carefully."
Hanna Suessi watched skeptically as the Dolphin engineers reversed their heavy sleds and hauled the beam back out of the chamber. It had been their third attempt to fit a supporting member into a gaping opening in the tail of the sunken Thenanin vessel. They had come closer to getting it right,
But still, the lead sled hung back too long, and almost let its end be driven into the inner wall of the battleship.
"There now, Olio, here's how you avoid that beam."
He addressed the pilot of the lead sled, his voice projected from the sled's hydrophones.
"When you get to their hieroglyph thingy that looks like a two-headed jackal, lift your nose thusly."
He motioned with his arms. The Finn looked at him blankly for a moment, then nodded vigorously.
"Roger, I'll dodger."
Soessi grimaced at the flippancy. They wouldn't be Finns if they weren't sarcastic one half the time and over-eager the other half. Besides, they really had been working hard. Still, it was a royal bitch working underwater. In comparison, doing construction in weightlessness was pure joy. Since the 21st century, humans had learned a lot about building things in space. They had found solutions to the problems of inertia and rotation that weren't even in the library. Beings who'd had anti-gravity for a billion years had never needed to discover them. There had been somewhat less experience in the last 300 years doing heavy work underwater, even in Earth's dolphin communities, and none at all in repairing or looting spacecraft at the bottom of an ocean. If weightless inertia caused problems in orbit, what about the most unpredictable buoyancies of submerged materials? The force it took to move a massive object varied with the speed it was already traveling, and with the cross-section it presented at any given moment. In space, there were no such complications. As the Finn reoriented the beam, Soessi looked inside the battleship to see how other work was progressing. Flashing laser saws, as bright as the heliarc lamps, illuminated the slow dismemberment of the central cavity of the Thenanin battleship. Gradually, a great cylindrical opening was being prepared. Lieutenant Tisht was supervising that end of the work. Her workers moved in that unique Neo-Fin pattern. Each dolphin used his eyes or instruments for close work. But when approaching an object, the worker's head would bob in a circular motion, spraying narrow beams of sound from the bulbous melon that gave the Terciops porpoise its highbrow look. The sound-sensitive tip of his lower jaw waved to build a stereoscopic image. The chamber was filled with creaking sounds. Soessi never ceased to marvel that they made anything out of the cacophony at all. They were noisy fellows, and he wished he had more of them. Soessi hoped Hikahi would get here soon with those extra crewfen. She was supposed to bring the longboat or skiff, giving Soessi a place to dry off, and the others a chance to rest with good air to breathe. If his gang weren't relieved soon, there would be accidents. It was a devil of a plan Orly had proposed. Soessi had hoped that Krydike and the ship's council would come up with an alternative, but those objecting to the plan had failed to offer anything better. Streaker would be moved as soon as the signal came from Thomas Orly. Apparently Krydike had decided they all had little to lose. A crunch sound carried through the water. Soessi winced and looked around. One end of a Thenanin quantum break hung limply, broken at the join by the end of Olio's bracing beam. The usually impassive Finn looked at him in obvious distress.
"Now, boys and girls," Soessi moaned, "how are we going to make this shell look like it survived a fight if we do more harm than the enemy ever did? Who'd believe it could fly with all these holes in it?"
Olio's tail slashed. He let out mournful chirps. Soessi sighed. After 300 years, one still wanted to tread lightly with dolphins. Criticism tended to break them up. Positive reinforcement worked much better.
"All right. Let's try it again, Carefully. You came a lot closer that time."
Soessi shook his head and wondered what kind of lunacy had ever driven him to become an engineer. Chapter 32 Galactics. The battle had moved away from this region of space. The Tandu fleet had once again survived.
The Pathaka faction had joined with the Thenanin and Gubru, and the lot of the Soro remained dangerous. The Brothers of the Night had been almost destroyed. The Acceptor perched in the center of its web and peeled back its shields in careful stages, as it had been trained to do. It had taken the Tandu masters millennia to teach its race to use mind shields at all, so loath were they to let anything pass unwitnessed. As the barriers fell, the Acceptor eagerly probed nearby space, caressing clouds of vapor and drifting wreckage. It lightly skirted over untriggered psi traps and fields of unresolved probability. Battles were lovely to look at, but they were also dangerous. Recognition of danger was another thing the Tandu had force-fed them. In secret, the Acceptor's species didn't take it very seriously. Could something that actually happened ever be bad? The Apesiarch felt that way, and look how crazy it was. The Acceptor noticed something it would normally have overlooked. If it had been free to esper touch the ships, planets, and missiles, it would have been too distracted to detect such a subtle nuance. Thoughts of a single disciplined mind. Delighted, the Acceptor realized the sender was a Synthian. There was a Synthian here, and it was trying to communicate with the Earthlings. It was an anomaly, and therefore beautiful. The Acceptor had never witnessed a daring Synthian before. Neither were Synthians famed for their psychic skill, but this one was doing a creditable job of threading through the myriad psi detectors all sides had spread through nearby space. The feat was marvelous for its unexpectedness. One more proof of the superiority of objective reality over the subjective, in spite of the ravings of the Apesiarch. Surprise was the essence of life. The Acceptor knew it would be punished if it spent much longer marveling at this event instead of reporting it. That, too, was a source of wonder, this punishment by which the Tandu were able to make the Acceptor's people choose one path over another. For 40,000 years, it had amazed them. Someday, they might do something about it. But there was no hurry. By that day, they might be patrons themselves. Another mere 60,000 years would be an easy wait. The signal from the Synthian spy faded. Apparently, the fury of the battle was driving her farther from Kisthemene. The Acceptor cast about, regretting the loss slightly. But now the glory of battle opened before it. Eager for the wealth of stimulus that awaited it, the Acceptor decided to report on the Synthian later, if it remembered. Chapter 33. Thomas Orley. Tom looked over his shoulder at the gathering clouds. It was too soon to tell if the storm would catch him. He had a long way to fly before finding out. The solar plane hummed along at 4,000 feet. The little aircraft wasn't designed for breaking records. It was little more than a narrow skeleton, the propeller driven by sunlight falling on the wide black wing. Kithrop's world ocean was traced below by thin white caps. Tom flew to the northeast, letting the trade winds do most of the work. The same winds would make the return trip, if any, slow and hazardous. Higher, faster winds pushed the dark clouds eastward, chasing him. He was flying almost by dead reckoning, using only Kithrop's orange sun for rough navigation. A compass would be useless, for metal-rich Kithrop was covered with twisty magnetic anomalies. Wind whistled past the plane's small conical nose guard. Lying prone on the narrow platform, he hardly felt the breeze, but Tom wished he had just one more pillow. His elbows were getting chafed, and his neck was developing a crick. He had trimmed and retrimmed his list of supplies until he found himself choosing between one more psi bomb to use at his destination and a water distiller to keep him alive when he got there. His compromised collection was taped beneath his cushion. The lumps made it almost impossible to find a comfortable position. The journey was an unending monotony of sea and sky.
twice he caught sight of swarms of flapping creatures in the distance. It was his first inkling that any animals flew on Kithrop. Could they have evolved from jumping fish? He was a bit surprised to find flight on a world so barren of heights. Of course, the creatures might have been molded by some ancient galactic tenant of Kithrop, he thought. Where nature's variety fails, sophonts can meddle. I've seen weirder gene-crafted things than flyers on a water world. Tom remembered a time when he and Jillian had accompanied old Jake Demois to the Timbrimey University world of Kethrenlin. Between meetings, he and Jill had toured a huge continental wilderness preserve, where they saw great herds of Clydu beasts grazing the grassy plains in precise and complex geometric patterns. The arrangements spontaneously changed minute by minute, without any apparent communication among the individual animals, like the transient weavings of a moray pattern. The Timbrimey explained that an ancient galactic race that had dwelt on Kathrenlin ages ago had programmed the patterns into the Clydu as a form of puzzle. No one in all time since had ever managed to decipher the riddle, if there actually was one. Jillian suggested that the patterns might have been adapted by the Clydu for their own benefit. The puzzle-loving Timbrimey preferred to think otherwise. Tom smiled as he recalled that trip, their first mission as a pair. Since then, he and Jillian had seen more wonders than they could ever catalog. He missed her already. The local birds, or whatever, veered away from the growing bank of clouds. Orly watched them until they passed out of sight. There was no sign of land in the direction they flew. The plane was making nearly 200 knots. That should take him to the northeast chain of volcanic islands he sought in another 2 hours or so. Radio, satellite tracking, and radar were all forbidden luxuries. Tom had only the chart pinned to his windscreen to guide him. He'd be able to do better on the return trip. Jillian insisted he take an inertial recorder. It could guide him blindfolded back to within a few meters of Hikahi's island, should the opportunity arise. The pursuing clouds grew slowly above and behind him. Kithrop's jet stream was really cooking. Tom admitted that he wouldn't mind finding a landing site before the storm reached him. As the afternoon wore on, he saw another swarm of flying creatures, and twice he caught a glimpse of motion in the water below, something huge and sinuous. Both times, the thing vanished before he could get a better look. Scattered among the swells below floated sparse patches of seaweed. Some clusters came together to form isolated mounds of vegetation. Perhaps the flying things perched on those, he thought idly. Tom fought the tedium and developed a profound hatred for whatever lumpy object lay directly under his left kidney. The glowering cloud bank was only a couple of miles behind him when he saw something on the northern horizon, a faint smudge against the graying sky. He applied more power and banked toward the plume. Soon he could make out a dusky funnel. Curling and twisting to the northeast, it hung like a sooty banner across the sky. Tom strove for altitude, even as threatening clouds encroached on the late afternoon sun, casting shadow onto the solar collectors on his wing. Thunder grumbled, and flashes of lightning briefly illuminated the seascape. When it began to rain, the ammeter swung far over to the red. The tiny engine began to labor. Yes, there it was, an island. The mountain seemed a good way off, yet it was partly hidden by smoke. He'd prefer to land on a companion isle, one that wasn't quite as active. Orly grinned at the presumption of anyone in his position making demands. He would land at sea if need be. The small plane was equipped with pontoons. The light was fading. In the growing dimness, Tom noticed that the surface of the ocean had changed color. Something about its texture made him frown in puzzlement. It was hard to tell what the difference was. Soon he had little time for speculation as he fought his bucking craft
struggling for every foot of altitude. Hoping it would remain light long enough to find a landing place, he drove his fragile ship through pelting rain toward the smoldering volcano.
Chapter 34 Crydike.
He hadn't realized the ship looked this bad. Crydike had checked the status of every damaged engine and instrument. As repairs were made, he or Takata Jim had discreetly triple-checked. Most of the damage that could be fixed had been. But as ship's master, he was the one who also had to deal with intangibles. Someone had to pay attention to aesthetics, no matter how low their priority. And however successful the functional repairs were, Streaker was no longer beautiful. This was his first trip outside in person. He wore a breather and swam above the scarred hull, getting an overview. The stasis flanges and the main gravity drives would work. He had Takata Jim's and Emerson Dionides' word on that, and had checked himself. One rocketry impeller had been destroyed by an antimatter beam at Morgrin. The remaining tube was serviceable. But though the hull was secure and strong, it was not the delight to the eye it had once been. The outer layer was seared in two places, where beams had penetrated the shields to blister the skin. Brukita had told him that there was even one small area where the metal had been changed from one alloy to another. The structural integrity of the ship was intact, but it meant that someone had come awfully close to them with a probability distorter. It was disturbing to think that that piece of Streaker had been swapped with another similar but slightly different ship, containing similar but slightly different fugitives, in some hypothetical parallel universe. According to library records, no one had ever learned to control cross-universe distorters well enough to use them as anything but weapons, though it was rumored that some of the ancient species that outgrew galactic civilization from time to time discovered the secret and used it to leave this reality by a side door. The concept of endless parallel universes was one known by dolphins since long before humans learned fire. It was integral to the whale dream. The great cetaceans moaned complacently of a world that was endlessly mutable. In becoming tool users, amicus dolphins lost this grand indifference. Now they understood the whale's philosophy little better than did men. A tame version of the probability distorter was one of the dozen ways the galactics knew to cheat the speed of light. But cautious species avoided it. Ships disappeared using probability drives. Crydike imagined coming out of FTL to find a convention of streakers, all from different universes, all captained by slightly altered versions of himself. The whales might be able to be philosophically complacent about a situation like that. He wasn't so sure of himself. Besides, the whales, for all their philosophical genius, were imbeciles on levels dealing with spaceships and machines. They wouldn't recognize a fleet of ships any better than a dog knew its reflection in the water. Less than 2 months ago, Crydike had faced a derelict fleet of ships the size of moons, as old as middle-aged stars. He had lost a dozen good fen there, and had been fleeing fleets of ships ever since. There were times when he wished he could be animal-blind to some things, as were the whales, or as philosophical. Crydike swam up to a ridge overlooking the ship. Bright heliarch lamps cast long shadows in the clear, euphotic water. Crews below were finished installing the booty Suessi had found at the Thenanan wreck.